The rest of you, if you would be so kind, if you could please join me as God's people stood at the foot of a mountain, so too we stand, just to recognize that this is one of the primary places where we encounter God through his inspired word. And you'll note that we have been in this passage for a while, and there's no telling how long we're actually going to be in this, and there's some real reasons. I think, I've stated this before, that this is one of the most poetically charged, one of the most important texts that not just inside of the scriptures that have ever been written. And there's a lot here. And so we're going to tease out a little more. We might tease out a little more next week as well, just depending. But we're going to begin in verse 1 and read all the way until we get to verse 18 again. It begins this way: "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. And the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through him all things were made. Without him nothing was made that has been made. In him was life. And that life was the light of all of humankind. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. There was a man sent from God whose name was John. He came as a witness to testify concerning that light, so that through him all might believe. He himself," that would be John the Baptist, he was not the light. He just came as a witness to the light. "The true light that gives light to everyone was coming into the world. He was in the world, and though the world was made through him, the world did not recognize him. He came to that even which was his own, but his own did not receive him. And yet to all who did receive him, to those who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God, that is, children born not of natural descent, nor human decision, or a husband's will, but born of God. The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us, and we have seen his glory, the glory of the one and the only Son who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. John testified concerning him. He cried out, saying, 'This is the one that I was telling you all about. When I said, he who comes after me,'" meaning he who has a birthday after me, "'has surpassed me.'" He's beyond me because he was before me. "Out of his fullness, we all receive grace in place of grace already given. For the law was given through Moses. Grace and truth, though, come through Jesus Christ. Nobody has ever seen God, but the one and the only Son, who is himself God and is in closest relationship with the Father, has made him known. These are the inspired words of God." You may be seated. Those lines, right, the absurdity of them, I can't get over that, the claim that John is making here is that the one who was born on Christmas morn is God, and yet somehow also God's Son, and yet somehow also remains God. And the scandal of that, right, we call this the incarnation, the scandal of the incarnation is in those words, that the Word, or the Logos in Greek, became flesh. That word, carn, that is the word incarnation, comes from the Latin word carnis, which means meat or flesh, but it belongs to the etymology of other words that you're familiar with, like carnivore or meat eater, or this delicious dish known as chili con carne. Meat or chili with meat, or meat with chili, depending on how you like it. I prefer meat with chili versus chili with meat, but that's just me. But you're starting, hopefully, maybe you're not, starting to see how strange it is, what John here is saying, how peculiar it is when John says the Word became flesh, or maybe even a little discomfort. And if not, let me just push this a little bit further, because how I grew up, bluntness was a virtue, and rightly so, as were certain adjectives and verbs. It was sort of the nomenclature of my upbringing. And so we've come to the part of the Christian faith where my heritage actually serves me quite well, because John here is not beating around the bush when he says what he says here. Let's be quite blunt. In John 1:14, John, that word he uses that's translated as "the Word became flesh," is this Greek word, and maybe you've seen it before. How many have ever seen this word before? I know you have, some of you, right? So it's the word sarx. Paul will use it quite frequently in things like this. And that word, sarx, underneath it, very closely tied. In fact, you can use it and it will mean the same thing, is animal carcass or human carcass. It literally means animal flesh or human meat. And John actually will use the exact same word. It's just sometimes hidden in translations. In fact, the passage just before this, he uses the same thing. It's just often the NIV, and sometimes the ESV can be helpful here. It just depends on what translation you're reading. But this is what it looks like in the NIV, that we are now those who place their trust in Jesus, the one who was made flesh, our children born then, not of natural descent, and nor of, and the word there is human sarx. It's actually the same word. It's just like sometimes it will use it for decision or will, but he literally is saying, nor are we children of human meat or a husband's will, but born of God. Now, it's almost going maybe a little too hard in the paint or going a bit too far to translate that verse, the word became meat or God became meat. But I think it does make the points that he's trying to make, that sarx can be used for that, for either animal meat or human meat. But the least we can say is that the flesh or the fleshiness that Jesus took on is your fleshiness and my fleshiness, meaning he didn't become a ghost, which, by the way, in early Christianity, that was a thing. Like, Jesus sort of just descended in, drove the drone that was humans around for a little bit, and then sort of, that was a big thing that they were wrestling with and trying to struggle. He became a human being with a human body, like your body and like my body. And so nobody, if they had a microscope and were looking at his skin or looking at his fingernails, would be like, wow, that's some divine skin he has, or some divine cuticles. Those are nice, right? He didn't. If you were to look at his skin under the microscope, he would have had your skin. And he would have, the heart that you had, he would have had. The lungs that you have, he also had. The brain that you have, he also would have, depending on how many contact sports maybe you played or how many soccer balls you've taken to the head. But either way, your brain would be just like, say, his brain. He also caught seasonal colds, just like we would have caught season, maybe some of you have a seasonal cold. How many of you have a seasonal cold now? Please leave. He would have also caught something akin to the norovirus or something like this, right? He also, as a teenager, probably when he was working in the hot sun, his parents were like, at least put, you know, there was no aluminum deodorant at that time, which is very effective. They probably had to say, put some more of that myrrh or that frankincense or whatever you received at your birth, like put some of that on because you stink, right? He probably also, and I thought about this, strange things you think about when you have all these stained glass. I grew up in a church that had stained glass all around me, and so I was always trying to, like, well, I wonder what that is about. But I remember thinking, like, was there a time when he said, don't follow me? I bet there was. I bet there was a time when, you know, his disciples were kind of marching around, and he also had to say, actually, don't follow me here. I have to go use the restroom. I'll be back, right? He had to also relieve himself. Under stress, probably pain, his body would have experienced hypertension, high blood pressure, all the things that our bodies experience. But John doesn't just emphasize this at the opening of this passage, a pretty stunning one. He also stresses the fleshiness of Jesus in that first letter of his when he says, that which was from the beginning. He's suggesting the same thing as he did in the opening of John 1, that which was from the beginning, God, which we have heard, which we have seen with our own eyes, and which we have looked at and our hands have touched. And so he's effectively arguing there as well, is that the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God of the Exodus story, we've not just seen him, we've heard him and we've touched him. These are the claims that John is making in this passage. And so the importance, I think, of Jesus' body or his fleshiness is not something that all of a sudden becomes important or apparent in the Christmas story. It was always there. The importance of the human body was always there. If you go all the way back to Genesis 1, chapter 1, at the very end of that chapter, when human beings are created, that line, it is very good. And then throughout the Old Testament, the emphasis on not only the importance of the human body or even body/expressions of love that you find in, say, the book of Song of Solomon. And if you know that book at all, maybe you also know the Jewish faith didn't let kids at a certain age read that passage till they got of age, at which point all the kids here quick start looking at. But we know that the emphasis on the human body didn't all of a sudden become important just now that Jesus was born. It was there all along in the arc of the Old Testament story. And we know that nothing that we experience in this world is experienced without our human body. So the New Testament is not an aberration. Christmas is not an aberration. It's just a continuation that Christ came into our bodies. He lived in them. He died in them. He also rose in them. And now he's ascended in our human body. We spent two classes, I think, in seminary just reflecting on that. And try to do that. It's mind-blowing if you just think about it for more than just when you're sitting in the pew at a Sunday service. Like, just reflect for, like, put a timer for 30 minutes and just reflect on where is Christ now? At the right hand of God the Father, in what? In our human bodies. Now, yet also God. And what is he doing? Continuing to provide for his body on earth. And one of the ways he continues to provide for his body, his local body on earth, is with his body, which we're about to embark on together this morning. And so, even now, he's in our body, resurrected out ahead of us, and providing for his body. Augustine, 4th century church father, again, this was a huge thing. People were wrestling with, well, what does this mean? And he even goes on to speak of our bodies not being these ornaments, not these sort of vehicles that we just sort of drive around. They belong to the very nature of who we are. They belong to the essence of what it even means to be a human being. The Bible actually agrees that we are our bodies. We're not just our bodies, but we certainly are our bodies, emphatically rejecting this sort of idea that these are just these incidental things that we should just rid ourselves of and finally live in eternity, or we just drive them around for a time and get rid of them. No, they are aspects of our actual selves. They're aspects of our actual, what it means to be human. In many ways, science is just catching up with this, that we are our bodies and that our bodies are us, and often we don't want to even admit this aspect of us. In fact, the idea that there's a fundamental difference between you and your body is nowhere to be found. That's something that comes from Greek ways of thinking. It's not that we're only our bodies, it's just that we're not human without them. So that idea that there's a fundamental difference, there's a you and your body, you can't, that's a dualism that does not exist in the scriptures. We are far more and deeply connected to our bodily selves, that we're a we, but we're also only a we in our bodies. It's why we're incomplete when we're outside of our bodies, and it's why we need to be resurrected, and it's why the scriptures even point to this. And so what John here is saying is actually quite good news. It is good news that God became a human body because it means, again, to put it in maybe the bluntest way I can think of, is it means that our bodies are not bad. And in many ways, Christianity has come a long way in that. And there's always been pockets of Christianity that have been, let's just say, especially even in our even Reformed culture, where we think of ourselves as heads on sticks. But I think Christianity has come a long way in this, but there still are pockets of Christianity that are pretty anti-body, but you don't find that very early on, and you don't find that in this scripture. But I also think it's a bit of a stereotype that it's only religion or only Christians who sometimes take on this anti-body view of ourselves. Late modernity worked pretty hard and at making us, I would say, dissatisfied with our bodies and our bodily existence. There are, of course, the impossible photoshopped images, and now you add CG into that, the filtered images that we receive of Venus-like women and Hercules-like males that torment the sensibilities of the young. Or, let's just be honest, even based on some conversations I've had, and listen to torment even the sensibilities of those who are not so young. I was listening to an interview of a costume designer. This costume designer worked primarily with Marvel Studios in recent films. I haven't watched many Marvel films, but they were the person doing the interview was shocked to find out that despite the training, because if you know anything about the athletes, they're basically athletes at that point who train for those films, they are regimented. Like, they obviously have their own cooks and their own personal trainers and things like that. And then costume designer says, but we can't get the right shot always. And so they actually have to wear these suits that we make for them. And then the interview was like the ones you see those kids wear, like at Halloween, that have, like, they're all just like, you know, they're walking around in those Spider-Man's all jacked. And like, you see those little kids running around at Halloween, like that. And the costume director said, yeah, like that, but far more sophisticated versions of that. And then even then we have to CG things to get it right, to get the right shot. And then I was recently struck, just comparing and contrasting the Hercules films from like 1963 and 2014. You know, on the left, you have the 1963 version of Hercules, which, to be honest, I think most of us here could snap him over our knee. Maybe we need some assistance. But and then you go to the right, 2014 version of Hercules, also known as Maui. That's the world I live in, Moana and things like this, but also former Miami Hurricanes football player, WWE star, and obviously Hollywood extraordinaire, Dwayne Johnson. But just compare and contrast these two people and even two eras and all of these kinds of standards, and we could have shown many more. Hammer home, I think, the message that we either have to reach God or goddess-like levels in our bodies, or we are failures. Or often, those who are young and are tormented by these messages get to the place of embodying. There are some studies on this that show the message that they receive is that my body is bad. And it's not just certain versions of Christianity that can distort and have anti-body messages. But these images are the least of my worries and concerns. There's a far more ubiquitous and insidious disembodied dimension to our digital era, where we are actually attempting to completely rid ourselves of these bodies and upload our lives. And social media is a bit of a low-hanging fruit. There's some great things that come with it. I was just watching the humanitarian aid that was organized through social media out in California, and some of these different food trucks bringing people together and donations and things like that. I think it sometimes gets a terrible rap versus some of the connecting pieces that really can happen through it. But we also live in an era that tempts us with unlimited possibilities of existing outside of our physical constraints, of existing outside of our physical limits, in which we can be everywhere, anywhere, all at once, and yet nowhere and with no one all at the same time. Existing supposedly in this meta reality apart from any material reality, apart from people, apart from our locality. In many ways, we could even say that the human body has become frustrating to us. It's sort of become like a handbrake on our human ambition, or a restrictor plate on what we could scale, or the dirty ore from which we need to smelt the true spirit of who we are. Meanwhile, in this story, God is coming down into a body, a human one, in the person of Jesus. It's sort of like, as God is coming down into a human body, we cross paths with him trying to escape them, trying to escape our limitations, leave our miserable bodies, leave our miserable limitations or our locality behind. I was listening to an interview with an entrepreneur, and one entrepreneur was encouraging the other entrepreneur, you should start this other platform. And he said, no, people don't see what goes on behind the scenes, how I wasn't taking care of myself physically, the lack of sleep that I had, the ways in which my body was crumbling And yet, all we see is the, say, what gets projected in the digital realm. In many ways, this isn't that different from the second century. There was a Christian by the name of Marcion. Marcion was a Christian, but really struggled with this idea that God became human, as did most, by the way, early Christians, and he saw Christmas as a disgrace. And in his own words, he says, it is below God to have ever, or even to hint, that this God has been filled with human excrement. He saw it as a disgrace, meaning that the God of Abraham, the God of the Exodus story, ever had to use the restroom. And what I find so fascinating about the Bible story is it couldn't disagree more. There's a lot of irony in our culture, in our pathological and neurotic striving to leave these bodies behind. And the Word became flesh. And whereas we are culturally either embarrassed or maybe dissatisfied with our bodies, frustrated by their limitations or even their locality, and either have dreams of, say, uploading ourselves into the metaverse without any limitations, I think what makes the Christian faith so unique, what makes it so profoundly different, is that it actually embraces our bodies from head to toe, bringing with it a message of healing and bringing with it a message of hope to those who are either frustrated with their own, who want to devalue or damage them, or even bringing comfort and assurance to those, say, perhaps, who are uncomfortable in their own skin. Or even a message of hope who, because of the presence of sin and aches and pains, would say, rather, get out of these bodies. And even there's a message of hope that we will indeed receive new ones. Somehow the ones you have now, but transformed. Would you please pray with me? Our Father, Son, and Spirit, God, we thank you. We thank you for coming physically to us. Who can imagine? True eternal life, us. It's strange. God, we're reminded yet again how precious our lives, these bodies, even how precious our localities are, where you've placed us, every one of us. And yet as wildfires continue to burn, we're also reminded how fragile these bodies are and how fragile our localities are, our spaces are, and how dependent we really are on you. God, we know and we trust. Yes, even amidst disaster, real loss, real devastation, grief, that you somehow and in some way hold this world, each of our lives, even the very places where those lives were lived, in your loving hands. And so God, might you continue to give those impacted, those grieving, those devastated, beauty for ashes, the oil of joy for mourning, and the garment of praise for the spirit of heaviness and loss. God, we also give you thanks for your presence in every astounding, intimate detail, not just of our bodies, but of our lives. And your presence, your becoming one of us in our bodies, gives meaning to all of the firefighting, as well as all of our tears. To every one of our words, as well as our actions. To all of our anxieties, to all of our fears, to all of our longings. Only you, God, could ever transform our ordinary and even our misery and astound it with wonder. A wonder that can only point to your glory and the glory which ushers in ultimately real hope. In the name of the Father, in the name of the Son, in the name of the Holy Spirit, all of God's people say, Amen.